Mr. Dargrill, 9. We were talking about when you went back to Italy, early April 1945. Oh, yes. And you were saying how you were feeling, how men were feeling and how you were feeling about the... Because you knew there was the last offensive coming, and I presume you thought you'd be involved in
well,
it.
Well, we did. Because, really, again, you see, the 4 months or whatever we were in Greece was really quite a holiday, basically, you know, compared with winter in Italy and the conditions there. We thought we'd be in for the final push over the River Po, you see, and we were... My memory is not particularly good on this, but we went up, I suppose, a normal route from Taranto. We landed at Taranto, and I can't remember where we leaked or where we stopped.
But some of them went by sea, that one jaunt round to Ancona.
Yes. Yeah, I did. Yes, I did. With Harry Mine here. And the quartermaster was on this particular boat as well. Bert Newman. Yes, we did. On some sort of torpedo boat or something? Yes. Yeah, I think it was. And anyway, we disembarked or whatever. And we did. By then, the divisional commander was Major General Stephen Weir, afterwards whom I got. A funny thing, I met him once or twice. And he became Major General Sir Stephen Weir. He was knighted after the end of the war. Anyway, he'd been a brigade commander in the 2nd New Zealand Division. Now, after the war, I heard Brian Horrocks say, because he used to give a series of lectures, you know, and they were very, very good on military matters and war and so on. And I heard him say that so far, as he was concerned, he thought one of the best, or possibly the best division that he was concerned with during the war was the 2nd New Zealand. I heard him say that on the radio.
That Weir had, yeah.
Yes.
Now, so...
And you see that word came through that New Zealanders had captured a distillery, or a vinery, I suppose you'd call it, where they made the wine, you see. And I've never forgotten this, because they were the biggest butts I'd ever seen. Talk about a butt of Malmsey. Well, they were as tall as this room, and they must have held thousands of gallons, because there were numerous drunk New Zealanders, you see. And this thing, they came out of a 2-inch pipe, you see. And so when I heard about this, I thought, well, so I took a carrier out there, and as many empty jerry cans as I could find, you see. The jerry cans were 4 gallons for water or petrol or anything, you see. And where do you want it, sport? This New Zealander says. So it was a 2-inch pipe. This stuff was this vino, and and this vermouth, you see, was it was running down the channels in this place and so on. So he got this pipe, and he said, "Hold your can." Well, I held my can out, of course, half of it went over me, and my army issue Mac was never quite the same with these vermouth stains on it. But I got about 4 gallon cans, about 24 or so gallons of vermouth, and I took it back and we shared it out.
Was this actually for the celebrations?
No, it was before. Finished. Oh, yes. And we had it in our mess, and I think I gave some to the sergeants, and that's why we were drinking this vermouth for quite some time. But but that was in the 2nd New Zealand Division territory, you see, and so we had to go in their territory.
Now, what about the end of the war then? Because you weren't there long before V-Day, What do you recall of the celebrations? Because I see you're mentioned here that you were, you and Collins, dressed as two very attractive spots of frat.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, have in mind here, he got hold of one of the locals and borrowed a cart. You know, an ox cart, you see. And this covered wagon sort of thing. And they put on the side of the thing, "Off the Bleeding Racist," you know, which is the famous Geordie song, as you know, you see. And so he said, "Well, you two dress up, because you're only young, you see, the Russell Collins, and we borrowed frocks and stuff, some socks, because mine kept saving." I do remember that. and he was quite the part, Harry Mine here. He got some old hat, and we were going to Bleeding Races, and the method of starting these oxen was to go, "Oh, oh." And he had this off to a T, Harry Mine here, yes. Yeah, I remember that. And, And the night the war finished, you know, one of our chaps was quite seriously injured, old Freddie Grease. We were in some, we were in some farmhouse, I suppose, as a mess. We got in there that day because everything was extremely involved. Nobody knew where people were. And they'd blown the bridge to this. It was over a little stream. They'd blown the bridge and made a detour, and the engineers had the time to put up a temporary thing, you see. Well, of course, everybody was drinking everything they possibly could. You're going to get the impression of this thing. This, all I did during the war was drink, you see. But I'm telling you things that came to mind. And I don't know what time it was. I can remember Russell Collins firing a brain gun up in the air. I said, "Now, come off it, come off it. It's only come down on us," you see. But I can remember that Freddie Grease, who was in one of the, I think which company that Freddie was in, but he came to see us, and as I was going off somewhere else, and he had a Jeep and a driver, or he drove the Jeep, I think, because I could see it happening. They were going straight for where the bridge was, and they didn't stop, and they went in this river. He wasn't killed, but all his face was in quite a mess when we got to him, you see, because they should have turned left and made a diversion, you see. And that's something else that sticks out of mind, which I've forgotten about for 50 years, but Freddie Grease. And I got to went to Vienna after that, you see.
So everyone was pretty drunk that night from the sound, with good cause.
Well, I won't say he was pretty drunk, but and you must be getting very impressed.
No.
but there we are.
Now, you did move immediately up towards...
Yeah, we went over the Italian Alps into Austria. And then and another wretched thing happened to me that night, because the RAS must have gone ahead of us to make staging posts, and they accommodated garages and so on, you see, as we got in there. And we got to this place, and they were well sloshed, these three RASC chaps, you see, and I was nearly out of petrol, you see. So what's the petrol? Yes, sir, here we are. So what, I've got a jerry can and poured it in my petrol tank. Well, I didn't think. I got about 50 yards up the road, and the motorcycle spat in the stop. They put water in the damn thing, you see. I don't know how I got out of that mess. What happened? Whether a truck came along, we got the bike on, or went in the truck, I can't remember. But we went into Austria, and we went to a place called Wolfsburg, I think. And when we're at Wolfsburg, you know, you can remember there's been a lot of controversy over the years about the handing back of the Cossack division. And
before that, were you there when the because before that even the some of the Yugoslavia, the Croatians, had been sent back. Do you recall that? Before, I think that was may have been just A Company, but
no, I don't. No. I recall the Cossacks.
Okay, carry on. What about the Cossacks then?
Well, they were. We had to send them back to. Now, I think either called Judenberg, which is in Judenberg, or I can't remember. But I know afterwards, when I read about it, I thought, well, my goodness. Because they gave us a demonstration, these Cossacks, you know, a riding, one of them did, you know, I remember, I can't remember, because it was summertime by then, you see, early May, the summer, and he was riding his horse with no reins and no, and bare back, was leaning over and picking up his hat one side and picking up his hat the other. But we were, I'm sure it was the Cossacks who were sent back through our checkpoint, although the Russians weren't down as far as that. I can't think what happened.
How did they react when you sent them back?
I don't think at that particular time, by what I can remember, they knew. I don't think they knew.
Did you know what was going on?
No. All I do know is that they had, the Russians had so many bods and so many horses, and they sent back, there were so many saddles short. And it made me think, well, I don't know, who are these people, you see? Because I was never a political animal, you see, but of course it was life. I mean, all through the war, it was a, you realised afterwards that for 6 years, politics didn't enter into it, you see. No. So
now, what about, there are a lot of spare horses around, weren't there?
I mean, I had one. Yes, I had one. Yes, but they rounded up and sent back. You see, so far as I, because I think by then we'd moved, and I think the battalion were in a place called Bruckel, Brukel, or be pronounced it Bruckel, and I was in one of the villages, and the communists were. But all we did then, of course, and we've taken out all the bomb racks of the. Now, this must have been not long, it must have been in the early summer, because we'd taken out the bomb racks of the carriage because we didn't think we want them anymore, and we had them put them back in. Now, that was how tense the situation did get. And I had a car. With a Yugoslav marking, I handed it into the battalion eventually, you see. But the situation became quite tense, I think, when we were first into Austria. But then we moved up to a place called Wilden, not far from Graz, and we spent the winter there, you see.
Now, while you're at Wilden, I mean, two of the jobs that are mentioned are things like looking for ex-Nazis and that sort of, you know, patrolling generally, looking for that.
We used to patrol because the story went around that there were dedicated Nazis who were stringing cables across the roads to decapitate motorcyclists and so on and so on. Of which I was one, among other things.
But you didn't find any evidence.
No, I didn't. And of course, no fraternisation.
How did that?
Well, it didn't work. People did fraternise. There's no doubt, you see.
What were the Austrians like to you?
Well, let me say to you that I never met an Austrian who agreed with Hitler. But then when I see on the newsreels, in 1938, when they marched into Austria and into Vienna, and the millions of people who were cheering and shouting, I thought, well, I wonder where all those came from. But, oh no, they were opposed to this. Although they did say to me, one woman who had been an interpreter, her English was faultless, much better than mine. She said to me, when we first saw your troops in Graz, because discipline, particularly, I will say this, discipline among perhaps the supporting arms was never what it was in the infantry, you see. I'm talking about some other cause, you see. The people were saying these people will never beat the Russians, so they were already thinking then. They were thinking ahead of, well, as troops, what do we care about the international political situation, you see, but they did. they were aware of it then, and they never beat the Russians, you see. And I think also, well, I've forgotten all about this, we had a German unit, a complete unit of officers and near Berlin, about 100, I suppose, complete with officers, and they'd invite you down to have a glass of schnapps sometimes. So I didn't know, one or two, the intelligence officer didn't, and so on. But there was pressure from presumably the Soviets, because the officers were taken away, because it was said that the British were holding complete German units, you see. So the atmosphere was there at that particular time.
What about in Vienna when you went? You went. There were the ceremonial guard unit in Vienna, weren't you?
The first unit in there, I think. You know. Yes.
What do you remember of Vienna? Was there? You were there a month or so, weren't you?
Yes, the first month. We did a month's tour of duty in Vienna. In Vienna, and the place was. The rubble hadn't been cleared from the streets or anything, but a lot of buildings were intact, you see. And since St. Stephen's, the famous church, was intact, not that I went in there, I didn't, but I should have done now, which I hadn't done. I didn't. And there was no fraternization at all, really, with the Russians whatsoever. A, they spoke an entirely different language anyway. We did with the Yanks, of course. We used to go to the American club there in Vienna. And one thing we had to do, we had transport, we always had to move the rotor arm, you see, so it was, to all intents and purposes, mobilised, you see. But that's a, well, what do you think?
Anything else about Vienna?
No, not really.
I think you went back to Wilden, didn't you?
Yes, after that we went back to Wilden. And I think the battalion were disbanded in January, I think.
January or February, yeah, January. Yeah.
Yes, and I had to go, because my age group, I think my age and service group was 27, because I didn't come in the army until January 1940, January the 15th, 1940, I said to you last week. I was posted to the Foresters, which were a sister unit, a brother unit with our brigade.
Second Fifth Sherwood Foresters.
Yes. And I went to the Foresters.
Now, how did they, because we've done lots of interviews with them as well, how did they strike you? Were they different from the Durhams, or were they as good? Or, I mean, they weren't in action, but I mean, what did you think when you got there?
Well, I've done pretty well with the Foresters, really. I didn't think they were quite as good as the DLI, perhaps, but as a unit, but there they are.
And why not?
Of course, again, I got another. I had, when our MT officer left, Morris Richardson, because he was, he left much before us, I took his job over, so I had the MT, which was quite a good job. You had all the battalion motor transport, and I also got the job in the forest because their MT left. So there we are.
How long were you with them?
Well, I the catalogue. I don't think I got home till July, miles after my time. Because when I was MT of the Foresters, one of the fitters took out a vehicle and mowed some civilians down at night time. And he was unauthorised, you see. So as platoon commander, I had to stay for the court of inquiry that was on. I don't think he didn't kill anybody, but he mowed them down, you see. And it was because it was peacetime, you see, it was quite a...
How was it? I mean, was he? He was charged with it. Was he found guilty, or who was found responsible?
I don't know, because I went to see the colonel, the brigadier. I said to the colonel, "Can I see the brigadier?" Because I didn't know when I was going home, you see. And so I went to see him and put my case. He said, "Well, I'm very sympathetic, sir." The words of that effect. He said, "But I'm afraid you'll have to stay for this." So I couldn't. He wasn't a brigadier I knew. He
wasn't Block.
Oh, no. It certainly wasn't Chipley. And I had to stay. But then suddenly, I didn't have to wait. One day, the adjutant said, you can go. I said, what do you mean you can go? He said, well, they decided now that they won't want your evidence. Or the chap had decided to
plead guilty.
Plead guilty, you see. So, I got home about. I got home in July sometime, and that was it. Yeah.
And you were demobilised then.
Yeah.
You did. You just went back to farming. Obviously, we're in a farm now. Yes. You went back to your farm.
Yes. Well, for 10 years, I managed a place for my brother-in-law, and we built up. We had a retail business. You see, he had a dairy herd, and we used to buy from. And we built up quite a big business. And he was much older than me. He was 17 years older than me. And so he decided to retire. And this place came on the market then, you see. And I scraped together every penny I could and bought it, you see, which is, it's been a very, very good investment, actually, you see. And so that's how it all.
And how had the war affected you overall? Had there been any good effects, good or bad effects, mentally or physically or in any other way that you can remember?
That's my brother. He was a navigator in Bomber Command, and he was shot down on his 21st birthday over Heligoland. And they didn't tell my parents this, but one of them was chaps in my platoon. His wife worked in RAF Records at Stanley or somewhere. And he said, the last heard of your, because I was going to find out, and he said, the last we heard of your brother was they gave the distress signal of that particular, of his plane, you see, and they were seen in flames over Heligoland. But I didn't tell my parents that, so he was probably burnt to death. But, no, on the whole, I think you accept the war as you accept most things, really. Well, I did anyway, as far as I could.
Did
it I was a good soldier, but there we are.
Did it give you nightmares for things after the war?
No,
or
no.
You were all right?
No, not at all. Not at all.
How about settling back to civilian life after four or five years in the army, 6 years in the army? Did that cause any problems to you?
Well, yes, it did a bit, because you were... because I think you were as a wartime commission officer, you were even elevated. I think you had power and so on, and, even though it might be very limited, but you were accustomed to giving orders which were obeyed, and you had to alter your mode once you got back into civil industry, particularly if you were talking to a chap who'd been private blogs. In and out of trouble all through the war, you see. Sod you. Oh.
That's right.
You mate, you see. So one has to be, yes, on the whole. But we've been very lucky, my lot. I'm talking about personal things now. My wife and I have been very lucky because we worked. She was very, very, very good indeed. She's the same age as me, you see. And she ran the clerical side of the farm, used to cost everything and so on, and know which crops to grow and so on. And we had a river here, and we started irrigation before most people had it. So in those days, before the great supermarket rise, you see, there are times of shortages, and in times of shortages, if you get the stuff, you could do very well, you see, and so on. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.